The Falling Middle Cast is a spin-off series from the creators of Mars on Life. This series provides review and commentary of Barbara Ehrenreich's Fear of Falling, The Inner Life of the Middle Class. Since this series analyzes the text and provides a critique on class in America, this is not a comprehensive audiobook and follows all copyright claims. Now, back to the show. Back with the Falling Middle Cast. Sebastian, to you, baby.
It's chapter 5. It's the yuppie strategy. Now we know who to demonize. Let's get right into it. We're almost at the end.
Yeah.
Like there's not a lot left.
And believe me, everything that you said in the last episode about how, like, oh, if this is the point that you wanted me to get at where everything just went kablooey from my head, I really thought it was going to be the end of chapter 5, not the end of chapter 4. That was going to make you be like the Tim and Eric thing of the guy
That just makes me even more excited.
Oh,
meaning
boy.
That there's still more to go.
Oh, yeah.
The yuppie strategy. Like every other social group to rise to fleeting prominence, the yuppies were as much invented as discovered. The term was first employed in the press for the modest purpose of explaining Gary Hart's unexpected success in the 1984 presidential primaries. Someone had voted for him, someone young, urban, and professional, and there was brief hope that this new grouping would provide the Democrats with a much-needed new constituency. But what started as a neutral demographic category evolved with alarming speed into a social slur. 4 years after their discovery, Hendrik Hertzberg wrote in Esquire, "Yuppie is now understood almost universally as a term of abuse. You're a yuppie is taken to mean not you're a young urban professional, but rather you have lousy values," something that I think everyone loves to criticize their fellow man over. See, yuppie is a hybrid category, a mixture of age, address, and class. See, now we can separate it. We can call people ageist. We can call people classist. We can call people poor or demographically poor based on their address. But see, here it's consolidated. So try to follow along with us. Let's take it back to the 80s. Let's not stay in 2023 because God knows no one wants to. Other social classes are in the middle class imagination, age groups too. The poor as children, blue-collar workers as stern, though somewhat pitiable fathers. But yuppies were by definition young adults, and thus subject to the moral judgments that older and more established people routinely pass on the young. From one angle, yuppies were the good children so sorely missed by neoconservatives like Midge Dechter in the 60s and early 70s. They did not waste time, quote, finding themselves. Oh, God, I should have said that in like a sorority girl finding themselves kind of dialect or joining radical movements. They plunged directly into the economic mainstream, earning and spending with equal zest. To Newsweek, the yuppie eagerness to go for it was a healthy sign of the yuppie virtues of imagination, daring, and entrepreneurship. And if that were to be where the cutoff point was, no problems whatsoever, right? They were also the very worst children. The apotheosis of middle-class forebodings about the corrupting effects of affluence. No one hurled the still-potent diagnosis of permissiveness at them, perhaps because by the 80s, the word referred to so much more than child-raising practices. Yet here they were, displaying that dread trait customarily assigned to the poor, quote, inability to defer gratification, and even the desperate orality. Oh, and even the desperate orality Oscar Lewis had once detected in the culture of poverty. See, yuppies did not devote their youth to, quote, that patient overcoming and hard-won new attainment. I say as I drop my book. See, that's where Ehrenreich wants me to stop reading, because she knows I'm just going to completely have a field day with this.
Like that LA Philharmonic Tchaikovsky listener.
Which, by the time this episode comes out, will be completely dated, but I don't care.
Just people just don't understand culture, or do they? And are they trying to build upon it? See, is it a derivative work? Could it now be considered... What symphony was it?
Oh, shoot. Fifth?
Fifth? Okay, well, now it's the sixth. It's a new iteration. They didn't anticipate Amon being in there, but now it's a new installment. Yuppies did not devote their youth to that, quote, patient overcoming and hard-won new attainment that Dector had endorsed as the prerequisite to adult middle-class life. They did not study, say it together, they networked. They did not save, they spent. And they did not spend on houses or station wagons, but on Rolex watches, Porsches, quick trips to Aruba, and most notoriously, high-status food. In this Year of the Yuppie cover story, Newsweek found them on, quote, what the fuck, dude? Oh, God, I feel like I'm in, like, a Humanities 101 class reading this shit. A new plane of consciousness? A state of transcendental acquisition? Am I at Coachella here? Yuppies, of course, did not turn out to be a new constituency for liberalism. Their, quote, virtues of entrepreneurship and acquisition made them, for the most part, conservatives, though not in the fervid ideological style of the neoconservatives or the new right. Yuppies thought of themselves as members of an elite whose interests might naturally collide with those of the lower classes, like those not able to afford a ticket. They lived in gentrified neighborhoods from which the unsightly poor had been freshly cleared. They worked for firms intent on minimizing the labor costs of blue and pink collar workers. Their lifestyle was supported by the labor of poorly paid, often immigrant, service workers, housekeepers, restaurant employees, messengers, and delivery boys.
See, I read this paragraph and thought, okay, so everything I thought about certain individuals in my life that lived through the 80s that shall go nameless, and my relationships to them shall go unannounced, all but confirms to me that they were pseudo-yuppies. You know, and they continue to be so well into the early 2000s, despite yuppies being a virtually extinct species by, what, 2000, maybe? I mean, they evolved, not in a good way,
but better, Yet, despite their political conservatism, everyone sensed that the yuppies were somehow connected to that last period of youthful assertiveness, the 60s. Some commentators presented them as grown-up radicals, covertly burying the heritage of the 60s into the corporate rat race of the 80s. And it was possible, in fact, to have been a radical in the first decade, and a self-centered hustler the second. As Jerry Rubin's transformation from rebel to networking impresario illustrates. The very word yuppie had originally been coined in 1983 to describe Rubin's transition from a yippie, the acronym for the anarcho-hippie Youth International Party organized by Rubin and Abby Hoffman, to prototypical young urban professional. Newsweek saw yuppies as the vanguard of the baby boom generation, which had marched through the 60s and was now speeding toward the airport, advancing on the 1980s in the backseat of a limousine. Actually, the stereotypical yuppie, who was about 30 in 1984, was more likely to have spent the 60s bicycling around the neighborhood than marching on Washington. With equal disregard for the normal length of generations, yuppies were sometimes presented as the rebellious children of 60s radicals who, in stunning reprisal, were now horrifying their parents with their self-centered and political conservatism. Oh, pray thee tell. It's like looking in a mirror, but worse. Actor Michael J. Fox, the only yuppie actually pictured in Esquire's Days of Wine and Sushi cover story, could ordinarily be found in a sitcom whose single sustaining joke was the clash between Fox and his gentle, sensitive 60s generation parents. See also, I guess, Back to the Future? I guess? Maybe?
No, because think of it this way. His parents were that previous generation of conformity. So in a lot of ways, like, despite the fact that, you know, Marty's parents would be all, you know, oh, Marty, going out with a girl, oh, God, like, And obviously it's the hypocrisy of, well, it means,
yeah,
you know.
Well, you go back to the 50s. Oh, who's this girl who's trying to latch on to me? That's my mom. You know.
Whoa. yeah.
Despite the frequent confusion of yuppies and baby boomers in general, yuppies, defined by lifestyle and income, made up only about 5% of their generation. They were exemplars, not of their generation, but of their class. The same professional middle class that had produced the student rebels. And like the 60s rebels, the yuppies were at the cutting edge of their class, a kind of avant-garde, charting a new direction and agenda. Well, when the avant-garde becomes the guard, you give me a call. It's not fun. They were also, in their own way, rebels. Both radicals and yuppies rejected the long traditional path to middle class success, but the defining zeal of the yuppies was to join another class. The poor. Right? No. No, of course. That'd be too easy. Why side with your fellow man? The rich. The rich. And the actual number of demographically official yuppies, people born between 1945 and 1959, earning over $40,000 a year in a professional or managerial occupation and living in urban areas, was only about 1.5 million, hardly enough to warrant excitement. If yuppies were further defined as greedy, shallow people, prone to burble about the joys of real estate investment, like those depicted in Newsweek's cover story, then, as a commentator in The New Republic observed, there were probably no more than 113 of them nationwide. But there was certainly a yuppie style of work and consumption, as well as what could be called a yuppie strategy for success. And these embraced, to a greater or lesser extent, many thousands of middle-class people beyond the demographic category. Here, I will use yuppie in a loose, rather than demographically precise sense, for someone who adopted the strategy and more or less fit the style. Hardly anyone, of course, deserves to bear the full burden of the stereotype. Okay, here we go. Let's see if we can be sequestered into a box that Aaron Reich is portraying for us. It's like a game show.
Mm-hmm.
But even the stereotype plays an important role in our chronicle of emerging class awareness. With the image of the yuppie, the normally invisible, normally, quote, normal middle class finally emerged in the mass media as a distinct group with its own ambitions, habitats, and tastes in food and running gear. The class usually privileged to do the discovering and naming of classes had itself been discovered by the media and, with scant respect for its dignity, named with a diminutive that rhymes with puppy. Of course, those who followed the yuppie strategy did not represent all of their class. They were exemplar, remember? They were a select segment, just as the Wright's version of the new class had been a selected subset of the larger professional middle class. In fact, the two groups, yuppie and new class, are, technically speaking, complementary. The new class, as defined by the neoconservatives, was that part of the professional middle class that finds an occupational home in the media, in the public sector, and in the nonprofit world exemplified by the university, foundation, social welfare agency. You get the picture. And the new class, by the Wright's definition, was solidly and unrepentantly liberal. The yuppies, on the other hand, they represented the more than 60% of the middle class that earns its living in the direct service of corporate power, as executives, corporate lawyers, and other sorts of business-employed professionals, consultants, or brokers. They were the fulfillment of the neoconservatives' dream that intellectuals, or at least members of the professional middle class, might abandon any remaining concerns for the lower class and become the trusted courtiers of the corporate elite. But the very frivolity of yuppies, and hence of the very subject of yuppies, was a distraction from the deeper changes their appearance signaled. In the 80s, the class contours of American society were undergoing a seismic shift. The extremes of wealth and poverty moved further apart, and, as if stretched beyond the limit of safety, the ground in the middle began to tremble and crack. Whole occupational groups and subpopulations, farmers, steelworkers, single mothers, all began to tumble toward the bottom. Other groups, lower-level white-collar employees, school teachers, even higher-status professionals and their families, found themselves scrambling to remain in place. And in the confusion, only one group outside of the very rich seem to have a very clear strategy for success. And perhaps it was because that strategy involved such a betrayal of traditional middle-class values, such a wholesale surrender to the priorities of profit and the pleasures of consumerism. Ideally, on paper, it sounds like a good thing, right? But here's the twist, that the media turned so quickly against those who followed it. Implicit in the media's half-mocking, half-indulgent, quote, discovery of yuppies was the incipiently liberal understanding that their strategy might not, after all, be the way to go. Told you I'd call it.
All right. The polarization of America, or as I would call it, evergreen. It was possible, until the 80s, for a comfortable American to think of class as a form of cultural diversity, parallel to ethnicity to even, or even, lifestyle. As I belch, but try not to go full burp into the mic at Charles Entertainment Cheese. That was funny. That burp in the middle of that discussion with Matt, just all of a sudden. Rah!
I knew you'd like it.
The emphasis had been on the culture of poverty, or of the supposedly parochial subculture of the working class. In the mass media, class often appeared to be a way of life, even a set of options, adding color and texture to an otherwise increasingly homogenous America. In 1985, for example, a sidebar in U.S. News and World Report titled "Beatniks, Preppies, and Punkers, the Love Affair with Labels," juxtaposes categories of Americans, both faddists and economic groups. Oh, geez. Valley Girls, 1981. Fun-loving teens with materialistic values in their own style of dress. Leg warmers, cutout sweatshirts. Underclass, 1982. A part of the American population seemingly mired in poverty. Yuppies, 1984. Young urban professionals, known for their consumerist lifestyle. And chopping people up. But there's another more drier and less judgmental way of thinking about class. Hey, Paul! As an index defined solely by money. Who has it and who doesn't? In the 1980s, this grimmer view of class became harder than ever to avoid. Those who had more than ever, and those who had not were more numerous, and more undeniably miserable than at any time since poverty was, quote, discovered. Again, evergreen. Sometime in the late 60s, American society had begun to lurch off the track leading to the American dream of affluence and equality. No one could have known it at the time, but those were the last years in which economic inequality among Americans declined. Since then, in a sharp reversal of the equalizing trend that had been underway since shortly after World War II, the extremes of wealth had grown farther apart and the middle has lost ground. I feel like I've heard a presidential candidate, two-time presidential candidate, make a similar accusation. Since economists even began to predict that the middle class, defined simply as those with middling amounts of money, would disappear altogether, leaving America torn, like many third world societies, and Tommy Wiseau, between an affluent minority and an army of the desperately poor. Sebastian shakes his head in disapproval.
Oh, no, not disapproval. You just got me good with that.
I think of another podcast talking about the lead up to disunion before the Civil War and just hearing one of the hosts get totally caught off guard. And he just goes, you turn me a pot, Lisa. And then they cut it with the actual line from the movie.
You are tearing me apart, Lisa!
There is still a middle class in the statistical sense. At least, a graph of income distribution still comes out as a bell-shaped curve, with most people hovering near the mean income rather than at either extreme. If the middle range of income actually disappeared, the curve would have two humps, rather than one smooth peak in the middle. But in the last decade, the curve has slumped toward the lower end and flattened a little on top, so that it begins to look less like a weathered hill and more like a beached whale. To the untrained eye, the shift is not alarming, but income distribution curves do not change capriciously. Any change commands attention. The change is evident no matter how you slice up the population. whether you compare the top fifth to the bottom fifth, or the top 40% to the poorest 40%, anyway, and whether you look at individual earnings, household earnings, or employ occult-sounding measures of inequality like The Economist's Gini coefficient. In 1985, for example, the top fifth of American families, those earning more than $48,000 a year, took in 43% of all family income, a post-war high. The bottom fifth, families earning less than $13,200 a year, got only 4.7%, their lowest share in 25 years. Families in a somewhat arbitrarily defined middle range, $15,000 to $35,000 a year, saw their share fall to 39% of total family income from 46% in 1970. According to the Census Bureau, the income gap between the richest and the poorest families was wider in the mid-80s than at any time since the Bureau began keeping statistics in 1946. The widening gap between the extremes was in no small part the result of the conscious efforts of the Reagan administration. We love Ronald, don't we, folks? We love him. At the same time that the administration sliced viciously away at social programs designed to help the down and out, it rewarded Reagan's constituency of wealth with a series of generous tax reductions. The combination of spending cuts for the poor and tax cuts for the rich produced a massive government-induced upward redistribution of wealth. Between 1980 and 1984 alone, the richest one-fifth of American families gained $25 billion in income, and the poorest one-fifth lost $6 billion. Meanwhile, income at the extremes was also diverging. The poor faced wages held down by that miserly standard, the minimum wage. This is jumping the gun from, like, many episodes ago. Like, before episode 10.
Right.
Maybe before episode 5, I don't remember now. Which remained throughout most of the 80s at $3.35 an hour. Or $6,900 a year, more than $4,000 less than what the federal government defined as the poverty level for a family of four. In early 1988, U.S. News and World Report, which had once questioned the very existence of poverty in the United States, acknowledged that there was now 9 million working American adults whose wages were not sufficient to lift them and their families above the poverty level. They are people like Glenn Whitbeck, a short order cook whose $8,000 annual salary doesn't stretch to cover his two little girls' medical bills. Or like Charlie Scott, a construction worker whose money woes forced him and his wife into a shelter, and then, most recently, provoked a separation. As if rubbing its eyes in disbelief, U.S. News noted that the poor of the 80s did not fit the stereotype defined by the culture of poverty and the ideologues of the new right. The concept of the poor as shiftless, black urban males unable to hold jobs, or as inner-city mothers on welfare whose sole work experience is the repeated bearing and raising of illegitimate children, end quote, the magazine admitted, was woefully overblown. At the other extreme, where wages are known more elegantly as compensation, there is, of course, no parallel to the minimum wage, no maximum wage to contain the greed of the already rich. In the 80s, while the median income of American families actually declined, the compensation of top executives rose dizzily. In 1986, top executives earned an average of $679,000 a year, up 9% from the year before. Executive incomes over $1 million from salary and bonuses became routine. Only incomes over $10 million raised eyebrows. In this decade of political reaction, no conscience, no shame, or, more likely, no fear of the have-nots seemed to restrain the ultra-rich. Consider the Society Page description of a party thrown by Malcolm Forbes of Forbes magazine, The Capitalist Tool, as the title of the article, in May 1987. Mr. Forbes' latest Highland fling, the Forbes clan hails from Scotland, included a regiment of 140 tartan-clad bagpipers and drummers marching through simulated mist. There were baronial Scottish stage sets whipped up by a designer of opera sets. There were 11-foot-tall flower arrangements dense with onoporden thistle, grouchy fireworks, laser beams, and as party favors, copies of the sayings of Chairman Malcolm for the lads and inscribed Revere bowls from Tiffany for the lasses. Once there, the guests, seated at 106 tables, supped on a meal whose raw materials included 24 hams, 700 baby pheasants, 100 pounds of foie gras, 400 pounds of haricot vert, 1,500 pounds of Scotch salmon, 24 legs of lamb, 60 country pâtés, 3,000 artichokes, 720 pints of raspberries and strawberries, 150 quarts of cream, and 15 gallons of butterscotch sauce. The Forbeses also let them eat, quote, celebration cake, and, quote, capitalist cookies. You see where somebody just starts thinking, wow, we live in a gilded age. Another one.
That's just straight up out of the platform.
Yeah.
That movie. Yeah, that's insane.
Yeah. And I did see that. I think I told you this already, but I did see that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wouldn't mind seeing these people in it. No one could any longer imagine that America was the land of one vast, undifferentiated middle class. In cities like Los Angeles and New York, the contrasts in wealth and poverty scandalized European visitors. High-rise buildings where two-bedroom apartments cost more to rent than most Americans earn in a month, while at street level, makeshift cardboard structures sheltered the homeless. The streets carried fleets of stretch limos, their windows discreetly shaded to frustrate the curious, while on the sidewalk, beggars of all ages searched trash cans for edible crusts. While these lurid, distinctly un-American images came to characterize the extremes of wealth and poverty, no less dramatic changes were taking place in the middle range of income. For one thing, a middle-class income no longer guaranteed such prerequisites of middle-class status as home ownership. According to the National Association of Home Builders, in 1984, a family needed an income of approximately $37,000 to afford a median price home, but in the same year, the median family income was only $26,167, almost $11,000 short. That gap marks a sharp deterioration in the prospects of middle income, mostly working class people. According to economists Frank S. Levy and Michael Mitchell, a typical wage earner in the 1950s faced housing costs equivalent to about 14% of his gross monthly pay. In 1984, however, a 30-year-old man who purchased a median-priced home had to set aside a staggering 44% of his income for carrying charges. For the first time in post-war America, a middle-level income no longer guaranteed that what we have come to think of as a middle-class lifestyle. So, brief side note that, I don't know, maybe I'll save for Mars on Life as well. But I was at a Bowie tribute show over the weekend as a special gift, as a surprise. And, you know, they went through the early phases of Bowie's career and, I mean, for the most part, left it off at the 70s and at the 80s. But at one point in describing the changes in music of the 1980s, they had a whole bit about Ronald Reagan. I shouldn't say a whole bit, but they featured footage of Ronald Reagan talking about how great it is to be alive right now. And there were a couple of whoops and applauses from the audience. And this wasn't in Worcester. This was in a town a decent ways away. Almost like an hour away, Norwood. And, you know, it's paragraphs like that, and obviously this chapter thus far, that makes me think, okay, what really was it, what was really worth applauding about the 1980s that, like, materially affected anybody? And I won't take the cinema and the music as answers, even though
I'd
be like, yeah, hey, you know what? The 80s had a lot of good music and a lot of great movies, but there was also just a great deal amount of shit given to a lot of people that were living at the time Almost to the level of how it was in the 1970s, and a hell of a lot worse than the 1950s, despite the fact that that was literally the whole point of Reagan becoming president. And I'm not saying this for dramatic effect, nor for the sake of, oh, people say it today and have been since 2015, but quite literally, Reagan ran on his words, making America great again. Well, 44% compared with 14% out of gross pay. That doesn't sound great.
Mm-hmm.
As an example, a middle level income no longer guaranteed what we have come to think of as a middle class lifestyle for the first time in post-war America. Like, that was the dream of post-war America that, you know, we've talked about before. But the idea that you're selling this dream and it's completely false, you know, why continue kidding ourselves up until right now?
Well, now we're at an age where we can look back on history and basically look at the mistakes and thankfully not be doomed to repeat it, but it's what I, yeah, really, hopefully in a perfect world, but it's what I stated last episode regarding how do you just go about selling your soul to the devil and think that this is how life should be lived, right? Just because of our country's doctrine of, oh, you know, do as you will, provided you don't hurt other individuals. And it's like, well,
unless they're X, Y, and Z.
It feels sort of bad of me to say, but I don't really think that it should be taken at that face value. If you're going to be encouraging and engaging in behaviors, like compulsive behaviors that are going to negatively affect you, and by all means is suited for a dead end, would you do that? You know,
right.
Like I understand that, you know, you give America any chance to get you hooked on chain smoking, they'll do it.
Oh yeah.
Maybe don't pick up the initial cigarette. And for some, I realize that it's harder than most, just based off of, you know, culture. Oh, well, all my friends are doing it. All of society says it's okay. Why not partake? And it just sounds very middle school when I say just, you know, don't be a follower in that regard. And if you happen to feel like you're part of the out crowd, so what?
Yeah.
I think by virtue of association, you know, sticking to your values is probably the most, I don't want to say like American thing you can do, but I feel like it engulfs that regard more so than just, hey, fall victim to these advertising agencies, why don't you?
Right.
Here's the habits you should be falling in line with. And at that point, it doesn't make me feel bad to verbally berate overtly hedonistic lifestyles. It doesn't make me feel bad at all.
Well, they're described as hedonistic. That doesn't necessarily... Okay. I would almost call them more depraved, but even that seems...
Sure,
like an exaggeration.
Depraved. You want to thesaurize it all you want. All yeah. I know is that it doesn't produce, it's unlikely that it'll produce anything positive.
Right. And
because it's a culture of addiction at that point. And
oh, of course.
Step away.
I mean,
maybe it comes easier to someone. Maybe it comes easier to others in contrast to other people who look at a bad situation and think, well, that's not something that I remotely want to partake in, so I'll yeah. steer clear.
I mean, it's very reminiscent of, and honestly, it would make for its own great miniseries worth talking about. Granted, it also goes way further back. The End of the Myth by Greg Grandin. It's probably one of my favorite history books ever, just because it totally conceptualizes the American mythology of expansion and what that means to individual the whole idea of individual freedom. You know, you could throw colonialism into the mix, of course, but also just what it means for Americans to hold on to that idea that if we just keep going and going and going and going, that frontier, it's just going to keep growing and growing, and more Americans can be out on that frontier.
I mean, I hate to say it, you keep manifesting your destiny evermore, you're eventually just going to wind up in the ocean.
Well, and that's where it does hit something that technically does go into the ocean. When I think about it, there's photographs of this object going into the ocean. But let's just say it very clearly hinted at in the subtitle of the book. It hits a wall, shall we say. So, and then the whole mythology is just like self-doubting itself to the point where nobody thinks the way that Americans literally thought continuously from, I guess you could say, 1776, you could argue 1790, whatever.
Sure.
Literally all the way up until 2015, where it's like, whoop, manifest destiny, not hot.
Yeah, looks like that was a bad choice all along. But they're going to spin it into a attitude of, well, let's just try something different. Maybe go north, maybe go south, maybe go back east. Who knows? You know, it's just one of those things where it's like, sooner or later, as much as people don't want to realize, you're going to run out of directions.
Exactly.
And it reminds me, and very quickly, because I know we have a little bit of pages left to go before our next stopping point. It reminds me of the plot of Tim Schafer's Grim Fandango, arguably one of the last best products ever produced by LucasArts. Yeah, check it out. Point and click adventure game. They re-released it on a bunch of different platforms. And
what was it called again?
Grim Fandango.
Grim Fandango. Okay.
Yes. In a nutshell, it takes place in the Land of the Dead, very Dia de los Muertos style. And the premise is that all those remaining in the 8th underworld are trying to get to the 9th underworld, and they have to get there through a variety of different means. In some instances, it can take upwards of 4 minutes, depending on how good of a life that you lived before you died, versus 4 years. You didn't live such a good life. You have to walk to the 9th underworld. And there was a line in replaying that game for like, God, third or fourth time that really stuck with me. It's that people who walk to the 9th underworld, they stop walking because they're so ingrained in where they are. They stop and they take hospice in where they are, and they decide not to go any further. And they essentially, as we're talking about, run out of direction to go. They decide that they are happy in being sedentary, and that their goal is no longer a goal because they're content. And it makes me wonder if individuals can ever have that without wanting to pursue more. I understand having goals and aspirations, hopefully not at the extent of other Native individuals when you do manifest said destiny, but I wonder if in them doing so, it was more egotistical than that. To say that they can do it, as opposed to them believing in some higher power to do it. Yeah. And that maybe staying put and not encroaching on others, or even sacrificing one's own sense of culture and livelihood expectations to become a completely different, unrecognizable person. Maybe that was what was needed all along. You know, maybe adhering to non-hedonistic or non-depraved lifestyles, both of which, I'm sorry to say, they don't have any positive connotations associated with them. Maybe that's for the best at that point. Because the alternative doesn't look much better.
Well, and in Grannon's argument, I'll make this brief too. In Grannon's argument, it's the whole idea of a safety valve where you contain, you know, the American populace in tight proximity to each other, you're going to get violence. You're going to get people beating each other up, killing each other because, you know, this land is my land. Blah. And get off my lawn. And you expand that and you tell people, oh, you can go over there. And if you feel angry, just go kill those Indians over there and you'll feel better because their land is yours now. And when there's no one left to kill, or you've gone so far outside of your own borders that you're killing the Vietnamese, or Afghan, innocent Afghans and Iraqis, then it begs the question of, okay, so what's the point now? And then that's when a blonde-haired orangutan shows up and says, you know, oh, we just gotta bring it all back, bring it all here. And then finally, it boils down to the ultimate dilemma, which is, okay, so have all these expeditions of imperialism in the last, you know, I'll isolate it since Vietnam, have they all basically been a precursor to let's bring the war home? So that, you know, yeah, there's nowhere else to conquer other than each other.
Right.
You know, within our own borders. And that's where it becomes an issue of a topic that's brought up a lot on this show, which is consensus, unity. How do you do that when you have a bloodthirsty populace that looks at the other half or the other side or whomever, anybody, any other, as the enemy? So, and you can do that when you've done your best to antagonize brown people from the Middle East, bring that over to brown people from the South, and realize that they are also a huge part of the population here, and now you've created a whole new war on your own footing. Grannon's book about it, it's tremendous. It's, I mean, I'd put that on the level of this book. It's that good. And like I said, it's one of the, I think, one of the best history books out there that I think everybody should read. Yeah, it's a little dated in the sense that it stops like right after Trump becomes president. But regardless, it's the fact that he's able to comprise so much American history and also talk about almost every president within the framework of that history makes it all the better. So, but the big news was that the middle class, or more precisely, the middle range of income, was becoming ever more sparsely inhabited. If the middle range was defined as lying between family incomes of $20,000 and $50,000, the fraction of families with middle range incomes declined from 53% in 1973 to less than 48% in 1984. Some people were climbing out and up, but others were sinking down toward the bottom. In 1987, the median income for men with five or more years of higher education was $34,731, and that for women with the same education was $26,399, or $61,130 for a couple. A high school educated working class couple earned a total of $36,888, more than a third less. The phrase, the disappearing middle class, which I, among others, used to describe the enormous changes of the 80s, in some ways missed the point. It was the blue-collar working class that was disappearing, at least from the middle range of comfort. In the new right's imagination, the working class was a precise avatar of traditional values, a human bulwark against permissiveness. But to the business interests that commanded the new right's deepest loyalties, the American blue-collar working class, with its once strong unions and real tradition of workplace defiance, had become a burden. Beginning in the 70s, the corporate elite did everything possible to shake this burden loose. They outsourced their manufacturing jobs to the lower-paid and more intimidated workforce of the Third World. They shifted their capital from manufacturing to the quick-profit realm of financial speculation. Corporate mergers, leverage buyouts, leaving American plants and technology to decay. And they led a brutal assault on the wages and living standards of those who still had jobs to cling to. For it is well to remember that what we call the working class, and picture as people striving to make a living, exists in the business literature only as labor costs. The corporate abandonment of manufacturing, or what economists Barry Bluestone and Bennett Harrison have called the deindustrialization of America, violently disrupted the life of the blue-collar working class. Between 1979 and 1984, 11.5 million American workers lost their jobs because of plant shutdowns or relocations. Only 60% were able to find new jobs, and nearly half of the new jobs were at lower pay than the lost jobs. One study found that laid-off steel workers in Chicago saw their incomes fall, on the average, by one half, from $22,000 a year to $12,500 a year, just slightly above the official poverty level. In the 80s, law firms did a brisk business in union-busting services to employers. including public relations drives to discredit the union and psychological methods of dividing and demoralizing the workforce. More brutal, brass-knuckle approaches also flourished. Between 1986 and 1988, three New York area union organizers of my acquaintance were beaten by company thugs, and two Queens factory workers who had participated in an organizing drive were pistol-whipped in front of their co-workers by the factory owners. This is like 1890s bullshit. Pre-World Wars. Mm-hmm. This is the kind of stuff they were doing when Eugene Debs was like, oh, maybe I'll run for president? But no, this was going on literally when television and MTV and Star Wars movies were all a thing. The Reagan administration set the tone of labor relations in the 1980s by busting PATCO, the Air Traffic Controllers Union, in 1981. This is a pretty infamous story. The administration then proceeded to all but eviscerate the Occupational Safety and Health Administration and the National Labor Relations Board, which guarantee minimal legal protections to labor. While the ideologues of the New Right extolled the virtues of the working class, the government of the New Right abetted the worst capitalist assault on America's working people since the 1920s. Middle-class people, professionals, and managers also suffered in the economic dislocations of the 80s. They too lost jobs when plants closed or when government-financed social welfare agencies shut down their services. They too experienced the stresses of a polarizing society in which the poor were becoming ever more desperate and the rich were becoming more numerous and brash, Elon. While the poor were increasingly to be avoided by, for safety's sake, the rich presented a different kind of threat to people in the middle, bidding up the cost of real estate to astronomical values and uncomplainingly accepting college tuitions in the range of $2,000 a year. If staying in the economic and social middle ground had become impossible for much of the working class, it had also become a challenge for those whose education and occupation entitled them to believe they were the middle class. Hint, hint, wink, wink. But the professional middle class is more resilient than those below it. A laid-off manager is more likely to find a decent-paying job than a laid-off assembly worker. Public sector professionals, like doctors, social workers, and administrators, can switch over to the private sector when the funds for public services are cut. And compared to blue or pink-collar workers, white-collar professionals are in a better position to negotiate higher pay to meet the rising costs of housing and education. Above all, the young of the professional middle class are flexible. Starting in the 70s, they began to abandon the long, penurious path leading to professional status and to go for the money. They didn't have to read Irving Kristol to know which way the wind was blowing. As the Boston Globe reported in 1985, Gary Rogers, 44, is a PhD who has taught at Harvard and Yale and written books on Diderot. Unable to get tenure, he settled for a job teaching rudimentary English to Citibank employees. Marie Wellington, 32, is a Harvard PhD in Romance languages who had hoped to teach in a tenured position. Today, she is a Berlitz language company manager in Chicago. At Cambridge's Ambassador Cabs alone, there are six PhDs as cab drivers. While PhDs in literature went hungry or learned stenography, jobs for professionals were proliferating in that vast area of endeavor known as business services. The expansion of government regulation in the 60s and 70s meant more jobs for corporate lawyers. The outsourcing of manufacturing to the Third World meant more, rather than fewer, jobs for American managers, as the United States became one of the great administrative headquarters of the, quote, global assembly line. In one short decade, American campuses went from being hotbeds of dissent to hothouses for production, oh boy, of corporate cadres. Between the early 70s and the early 80s, the number of students receiving bachelor's degrees in English fell by almost 50%, while the number graduating with degrees in business nearly doubled. It's kind of like when I think about a certain California school that really emphasized all those business majors and had billboards about it, but
of course,
God forbid, promote anything else.
Yeah. I mean, at that point, just make it a business school.
Yeah.
You know, like just make it an inherent business school, no other major.
Quite literally, geographically, on a map, they put baby in a corner. And I say that because I'm sure you know where the business buildings are at said school. Yeah.
Yes, I do.
Okay. Just wanted to be sure.
I get it.
I knew you knew. I knew you knew. I just, you know. It's...
I had an English class
mm-hmm.
in that building structure, which was weird. Yeah.
Fascinating. Okay.
It was odd, and it was so out of place, and it was a pitch and a half to get there. It was just off the beaten path. I didn't like it. I was a freshman. I had a lot of things I didn't like about being a freshman in college.
But hey, we met.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not all we met.
For 8 hours.
For 8 hours, yeah. That was fun.
Or three. Anyway.
It was eight.
The social sciences also took an almost 50% cut, and mathematics and the natural sciences, which presumably are essential for the future technological competitiveness of the United States, could together claim fewer than 4% of the college seniors graduating in 1983. Students were also choosing to avoid the prolonged deprivations associated with graduate study. In the sciences, for example, the share of doctorates awarded to American students by U.S. institutions fell from 76.3% in 1978 to 63% in 1986. In that year, for the first time, U.S. universities awarded more PhDs in engineering to foreigners than to Americans. The Americans had, so to speak, a better offer. They were skipping graduate school in favor of corporate jobs offering high starting salaries. As an engineering graduate student explained to the New York Times, one of the big things is being poor for a long period of time. If you can get a bachelor's and go out and make $30,000 or $40,000 a year, Jesus Christ, why get $10,000 a year as a graduate student? There had been a time when ambitious students saw corporate employment as an option for the intellectually handicapped. Now it was the professions that seemed like a dull, low-paid backwater compared to the brisk world of business. The choice of a pragmatic, business-oriented major was not always made happily. Many of the college students I talked to in the mid-80s were suffering from what might be called premature pragmatism. They were putting aside, at far too early an age, their idealism and intellectual curiosity in favor of economic security, which was increasingly defined as wealth. A young woman interviewed by Newsweek had switched from social work to sales because, "I realized that I would have to make a commitment to being poor to being a social worker." Hard to read that when I know somebody that's kind of a social worker in my family. Similarly, a Smith student, who happened to be one of few activists on that campus at the time, told me she had given up her ambition to be a psychiatric social worker because she, quote, couldn't live on that. Instead, she said wryly, she would be going into banking.
Yep, that cuts deep.
Yeah, anyway. I was not trying to read that with any kind of sarcasm, I promise.
I know.
Once I got to the end of the sentence, I was like, oh, farts. To an adult who might have defined social work as an eminently respectable middle-class career, decisions such as these seemed either ill-informed or childishly greedy. But in the shifting economic landscape of the 80s, what had once been a secure middle-class occupation might no longer provide the necessities, such as home ownership, of middle-class life. All over the country, students who had started out wanting to be environmental chemists, special education teachers, public administrators, or novelists redirected their aspirations to business or law. They did so in most cases out of a sullen sense of necessity, trading off personal autonomy, idealism, and creativity for what they hoped would be safety and possibly comfort.
I still hope that. Okay? Like, I still hope that. If you don't go rebel by your 20, you have no heart. If you don't go establishment by 30, then you have no brains. I get it.
Well,
I watched the movie, Kevin Spacey. Okay, I get it. But just continue.
Okay.
I thought I had more to say, but I've kind of already exacerbated my thoughts without even saying anything.
Think more about it if you got more to say. This part of the chapter is almost done.
Yeah.
In 1987, for example, a record 73% of students reported being very well off financially as their top goal, compared to 39% in 1970. Only 16% were interested in doing something to preserve the environment, compared to 45% in 1972. In other areas, students were now at least as conservative as the general public. Only 21% favored legalizing marijuana in 1987 compared to 53% in 1977. In 1984, only 49% believed abortion should be available to married women, down from 68% in the 70s. And I think now it's even way higher than it was in the 70s. So it's kind of like, hey, why get rid of something that's popular? Oh, that's right, because we don't matter. Peter Carlson, a former 60s radical, returned to his old dorm room at Boston University in 1986 to find posters of Miss Piggy, Sesame Street's Bert and Ernie, Kermit the Frog, a mural-sized photo of a bottle of Cordon Rouge champagne popping its cork, a poster of elegant sushi arrangements, and a cartoon captioned, "Shop till you drop." Almost lost amid this collage of cuteness, I spied a postcard of Ron and Nancy atop a desk. I wondered, is that a genuine homage or some sort of ironic protest? It was a genuine homage. A lucky, highly publicized minority of the new generation of pragmatists leaped directly from the academy to instant wealth. Beginning in the late 70s, graduates of Harvard Law School and a few other elite business-oriented institutions could expect to be courted with starting salaries above $40,000 a year. In Wall Street's bustling money factories, the goal of amassing a million by age 30 was neither uncommon nor entirely unrealistic. Most young graduates, however, could expect to attain eventual incomes only in the modest $30,000 to $40,000 range. For the majority who did not enter adult life with a legacy of Manhattan real estate, or who lacked the sang-froid for investment banking, the second rule of the yuppie strategy applied. Marry a financial equal. A 1976 ad for Psychology Today laid out the possibility of upward mobility through a new, more androgynous approach to marriage. Oh God, I gotta do that voice again. Not the Terrell voice, thank God. The ad, which ran full page in the New York Times, shows a smiling young couple wearing identical pinstripe jackets. Oh, God. The text begins in large, bold letters. "Our bank can't tell us apart." And continues. "Which one of us makes $20,000? We both do, and we like to spend it on the same kind of things, too. Now that we're married, we have twice as much money and twice as much savings. We'll be traveling together, and a lot more often. We'll also get to play more tennis, spend more weekends skiing or camping. And, now, we can have our once-a-month wine and cheese party once a week. I guess we know what we want from life. And with twice as much money, we not only can put more into it, we can get more out of it."
Hmm. You know what I smell? In that botched haiku of a paragraph. You know what I don't smell is the talk of having kids, the talk of owning pets, I guess in the business sense, having liabilities, as cutthroat as you want to say that. Oh, your kid that was just born, liability, takes money out of your pocket. It's not an asset. You know, I hate to sound like Grant Cardone here, but it's not an asset. Yeah, no, $40,000 between the two of you. That does sound like a lot of money, especially in that day and age. But do you wonder why that is? Of course, with these spending habits that I'm getting at, it's safe to say that that those hobbies just aren't going to cut it. And either these two individuals are going to spend way above their means in terms of traveling and what is that wine and cheese part? Impressing others. That's what I get from that. And with twice as much money, we not only can put more into it, we can get more out of it. I wonder by putting more into it and subsequently ignoring putting more into, I guess, what's for retirement, I wonder if you'll get more out of it then. Just a thought.
Yeah.
But I guess in the age of economic prosperity, or I guess in the age of economic nepotism, because what, you graduated an Ivy League college because your dad did? Who knows? I'm psychoanalyzing an advertisement. I'm just realizing I should probably stop. It's what they lock people up for. Talking about
absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, I think this is what's going to an overall point that I've thought since the beginning, and even since before we started this show. And obviously, we still have at least Mm-hmm. At least with this book, we still have maybe like 3 episodes left.
Right.
It's still that idea that, you know, you can punch above how much you make, and therefore you can, quote unquote, be like everyone else.
Why?
But when it comes to who is everyone else?
Why would you want to be like everyone else?
That's the trick. Who is everyone else? Everyone else is basically all of the rich freaks that,
okay,
you know, are shoving themselves down your throat saying, you know, oh yeah, you shouldn't have an abortion, but you should at least go skiing and go to the Hamptons every now
yeah,
and then.
Yeah, why would I ever want to be like these people? And I'm saying this very point blank. I'm saying this without any hint of like, oh, well, it's because of this. I know why it's because of this. It's because people like to live vicariously through the means of others or their possessions.
Greed, for lack of a better word, is good.
I'm saying it from a perspective of, don't do that, you ignorant fuck. Because it's not a fulfilling lifestyle.
Right.
It's not something that you should aspire for. And the fact that you want to live vicariously through your material possessions or achievements, it says a lot more about not only about who you are as a person, but as the society that has indoctrinated those to believe it.
Mm-hmm.
So get your head out of your ass and be your own person. I say hoity-toity sitting behind a computer, but it's true. I don't think it necessarily takes a lot for individuals to be fulfilled. And if other people want to seek personal achievement through means of education or social status through their job, they should be able to do so in the confines of how they're able to do so. But if you're doing this just so that you can impress others, you run the risk of just being the most insipid person in the room if you're not already that person in the room.
The sprinkling to the sundae that I would add is it's the idea that, oh, every American can be rich.
No, they can't be. And it took us
the problem is,
how many decades to figure that out?
That's basically been an idea since at least the 1820s. And I'm sorry to say, if it's taken us this long to still not get it,
right?
Then what is really worth saving?
Right. Then who can we retroactively call the idiots in this situation? The individuals who didn't bother getting rich because they can understand and see the system for what it is, or the people who are too hard-headed and stupid enough to still believe in the dream itself?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I'd like to thank the individuals not to be all hoity-toity and say, "Well, Seb, well, Ryan, you just don't want it enough. Fuck right off with your business acumen, dogmatic bullshit. You JP Morgan intern, fuck." I hope you fall down as fast as First Republic did. I swear. I hope your Dogecoin goes up in flames.
By the way, I've been getting like spam texts from Bitcoin randos being like, you know, hey, invest in this. And I'm just like, go away.
Why? No. Don't say go away. Say why. Why don't you, the person trying to sell me a dream, tell me why it is so imperative that I join in on your Ponzi scheme? Okay. Because at the end of the day, like a Ponzi scheme, it stops when they realize there's not enough people to sucker into it.
Right.
So if you were to approach a scammer, and let's just call these people what they are, trying to sell you on this type of dream, either by buying material possessions or thinking a certain way or aligning yourself politically with some party that they believe is going to be the key to salvation. Okay, let's actually humor these individuals and just ask point blank why they believe it's special. Because even if you don't take a religious approach to anything, even if you are a self-proclaimed atheist, I think you and I can both virtually agree that, I don't know, maybe worshiping false idols can lead itself to some negative attributes.
Oh, naturally.
If we can transcend religious and or scientific debate in that question and logically approach scammers with the question of, why should I give a shit? i.e. allowing them to stop dead in their tracks as they ponder and try to work through the dial-up modem that constitutes their brain. I'd love to see that. I'd love to see more people asking, why should it impact me?
Yeah.
Just because it impacts others doesn't mean I have to be subjected to it. But apparently due to geographic areas, due to race, due to gender, due to sex, due to all these protected categories, I need to be lumped into a box as well. Among many others, economic status, political status, social status, what have you, I feel as though I need to be lumped into a box. Why is the question on the table, is on the menu.
Yeah. I mean, without trying to sound repetitive at all, it really does boil down to all these ideas that are so innately American of, we're all equal based on economic status. But the problem with that is that we've refuted that so many times, only to not only, I would argue, devalue ourselves, but an extension of that, show the worst angels of our nature, to say the opposite of what Abe Lincoln said. It's tremendous. If we were ever some kind of avenging angel, how much we've fallen. And which begs the question, were we ever an angel to begin with? Hence why the whole idea of America losing its innocence is such a, I think, such a bullshit concept.
What innocence did it even have?
Exactly.
Outside of the fact that we wanted to be independent in our beliefs and not having to withstand any other foreign entities or government. And it's like, on paper, you had it right on paper there, guy. And if you would have just followed that paper to a T, and if you would have just let people mind their business, and if you would have just let other people not be suckered into whatever Ponzi scheme that you're doling out here, I wouldn't have had a problem.
Yeah, but even on paper...
I like a doctrine that enables me to think for myself.
Yeah.
I like that. What I don't like is individuals implying that they can think for me or have my best interests at heart. And for the whole nature of understanding, you know, ignorance and how it's taught and what have you. Okay, look, I understand that before age 18, I guess you are by and large ignorant to the world around you and can't do much of anything. You're not legally classified as an adult. And that 18 is this magic number where you're supposed to find all the answers to ascertain yourself as an adult. That's not the case. And I don't think it ever was the case. However, I think that parents do play quite a major role in our developmental upbringing. Ideally, they should be teaching us the best parts of humanity while subsequently fostering into why the worst parts of humanity are bad, and allow us to make our own decisions based off of that. And I think by going back to the basics, and again, it sounds so juvenile, but understanding what it means to recognize stranger danger and to not fall for peer pressure and to not worry what others think about you and to stand up to bullies and practice good habits all the way from looking both ways to crossing the street to, I don't know, don't give your social security number out in lavish yacht villa parties. I would hope people would have that moral groundwork. That's not what we see. We see people making decisions not with their brains, but with their hearts and with their wallets. And I'm asking why people think that that's okay, because you're not going to buy your way into fulfillment. For those really, really preaching the gospel, you're not going to buy your way into heaven. I'll tell you that. I guess my answer is merging into an overall question is, what do you hope to achieve by converting others to this lavish lifestyle and these lavish expenditures and basically making a hobby out of who has the biggest swinging dick at the convention? And I think I have an answer, and it's that misery loves company.
You know, all these principles that we claim to hold ourselves so dear to, you know, even the idea that we're a humanistic society of any kind. I mean, yeah, arguably from the get-go we were. then we weren't, then we continue to not be, and up until now, it's basically a debate on are we, and we're now at a point where the only people that ever want to argue about it are the loudest, stupidest voices in the room that think, oh, you're teaching secular humanism with pineapples, you know.
I mean, I can answer that question. We're not. So make the best out of a bad situation. Educate yourself to a degree and don't encroach.
It is
the best case scenario that I know will not happen.
Right.
However,
because I was going to say, I'd love to hear you say that on Fox News.
Hey, there's an opening. Carlson's gone.
It's true. It's true.
Yeah.
Well, I was just going to add too, like even the idea that it was good on paper to begin with. I mean, yeah, okay, you've got all the quote unquote, you know, Enlightenment principles, but I mean, even that comes with its flaws when you have quite literally, and this in a way ties back in the whole end of the myth, Greg Grandin discussion we had earlier. Using that thinking, I think back to the Declaration of Independence, where quite literally one of the grievances against King George III was he has excited domestic insurrections among us and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. So even quite literally on paper, we were sowing the seeds of our own discontent, even if they were the best intentions. So, and obviously this is extracted away from the whole class argument that Barbara Ehrenreich is trying to make, but still, there's the ethic, and then there's the execution of the ethic. And quite literally, the 1980s were the, at least as of right now, permanent, the execution of the ethic that its aftermath has been so far been, I would argue, deemed permanent because it's ongoing. You know, all those statistics, yeah, they've more than likely changed since 1988. But for the most part, the logic behind them and the logic behind why people do the idiotic things that they do have not changed, which is also kind of the overall point of this whole experiment and me bringing this book up to you in the first place is like, you want to know the base for all these things that we've complained about on Mars on Life, and we have every right to, we have every reason to, and it also feels good because it's cheaper than therapy. but it also gives us an idea, well, where the hell did this all come from? And so far, we're now finally at that point where we're at sort of the sunset of where it came from, because we've lived in the sunrise of everything that's come since, if I can be poetic for once.
No, that's great. Where we go from here is people make their own good decisions and they take others into account.
They
don't encroach. All hypotheticals, of course, but that's all we really have at the end of the day. If there's no other closing thoughts, you got me.
Well, that's episode 14. Bye, folks.
Thank you for listening to the Falling Middle cast. Our co-hosts are Ryan Mancini and Sebastian Shug. Episodes are produced by Ryan Mancini and feature music by Kevin MacLeod. Check out our main series, Mars on Life, or listen to our other spinoff, Diet NIMBY, wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.